This is the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 72nd in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am super pleased to have with me today Randy Sabat. Hi, Randy.
How are you doing, Gary?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us. Randy Sabat is a lawyer with the Zwilgen cyber law firm in Washington, D.C. Though he's a sought-after advisor when it comes to security and privacy issues and the law, Randy holds geek credentials as well. He's a CISSP and was a crypto engineer at the NSA. Randy served on the Commission on Cybersecurity for the 44th Presidency. In addition to his legal work, Randy teaches at George Washington University and advises a number of startups. He contributed to the book Beautiful Security. Randy has a JD from University of Baltimore and a BS in Computer Engineering from Syracuse. He lives with his wife, Marina, in Maryland. So thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's start with some recent news. So last week, Microsoft was heavily involved in a takedown of the Zeus botnet servers, and it appears that they participated in the raid in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and they put it on their website and stuff with some video. What limitations on corporations exist when it comes to cyber law enforcement, or should we just expect Microsoft to be the future police?
Boy, you ask really easy questions, Gary. I think the best way to answer that is to approach it from the first from the legislated side. In other words, the ability for private actors to get involved in these types of situations because of something called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which I think most folks are at least somewhat familiar with. Mm-hmm. There are a number of things that private corporations, you know, if they were to take those types of actions, they would get into trouble. On the other hand, if there is involvement with law enforcement, then the situation changes where the private actor may be authorized by law enforcement to do certain things and to take certain actions.
And given the, I'm sure that they were involved in that this way because they have not only armies of lawyers, but they're careful about this stuff. I mean, let's put a finer point on it. I'm actually pleased that the Zeus people are finally getting some action taken. And I sort of applaud Microsoft's use of the court system to do that. But I also worry about corporations going to law enforcement who, frankly, are pretty clueless when it comes to computer security, especially the FBI. And, you know, although they pretend they're good at it and kind of taking the law into their own hands. So I'm wondering what kind of controls we have on that.
Let me throw in my disclaimer here.
Yeah.
I didn't do it at the beginning.
Yeah.
All of this is just a discussion amongst friends, no legal advice, and these are the views of just me, not my employer, any of my clients, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I say that because I think some aspects of law enforcement do have a maybe somewhat earned bad reputation in terms of handling cyber events. On the other hand, I think there are other portions of law enforcement that really do a pretty good job.
Totally agree. I mean, the Secret Service guys are great, for example.
Exactly. I was going to bring up the fact that we work with the Secret Service on a fairly frequent basis, and we've found them to be tremendous in terms of not only from a client handling standpoint, in other words, getting through to the client, reaching out, saying there's a problem, but also the follow through and the working with the client in a way that is beneficial to both the client, the victim and the Secret Service, because
yes,
they gain a lot of information in working with the victim.
Yes.
But I think to your question, the issue comes down to one of, many years ago, what we euphemistically used to call active defense, which now translates to offensive types of behavior. And
well, it translates to I showed up at your door with a warrant and a bunch of marshals and took your stuff.
Well, when it's law enforcement, yes, that's where it has the color of law and it's permitted. And even in the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, there are exceptions when someone is acting under the color of law. But I think the other side of it is where you kind of described it as, you know, taking the law into their own hands and the companies going and doing something that, again, may be questionable or may even be illegal.
Well, however, no. So in the Microsoft case, I don't think that's the way to, the current situation we're discussing.
Right.
So I'm thinking more about, all right, so we have some fairly clueless law enforcement types out there, and a big corporation comes to them and says, hey, there's some cybercrime going on, and I need your help. Let's go bust these guys. and the Keystone Cops are like, yeah, let's do it. And then, right. Then what? Like, who's keeping an eye on this?
At this point, we collectively, you know, the country, we don't have the type of coordination that we should across the different law enforcement agencies. We have, as you're pointing out, we have very differing levels of competence. Mm-hmm. So my advice would be to any companies that are looking at doing something like this, whether they've been hacked or, you know, they just want to be proactive, make sure they reach out to the right folks. Again, I would point to the Secret Service first. But if you wind up with a group that's perhaps, as you said, the Keystone Cops, you know, you need to figure that out quickly and, you know, maybe have some of your own team kind of keeping a second eye on them. And if they seem to be going off the reservation in some way, you know, call in somebody else.
Right. Anyway, you know, that's a sticky issue. It worries me, and it's new, and I've only seen a little smidgen of coverage in the New York Times about it, and it was all positive spin. Mm-hmm. So I think it deserves some more conversation among people like us.
Agreed.
The next question, equally tricky. In fact, this one is even harder. So AT&T has been rumored to have cooperated with the NSA doing listening and wiretapping in the well-known San Francisco situation.
Yes.
So the international traffic loophole seems rather gigantic. And the question is cyber law full of such gigantic loopholes?
I think that presupposes that there is a well-developed body of cyber law, which there isn't.
Ah.
we have a number of somewhat archaic laws that have been you know, people have gone in with scalpels and carved out certain portions here and there and added portions here and there. But, you know, we're still, in fact, we're looking at in this Congress, we've got, I think the last I counted was 90 some odd bills that are cybersecurity related. There's two or three front runners right now. But the body of law that does exist is, first of all, very sectoral. Second of all, it's in many ways has not kept up with existing technology. So are there giant loopholes? I wouldn't even call them loopholes. I would just say they're gaps because the law hasn't kept up.
Right. Well, in this case, I was thinking of the notion of international traffic and how easy it is to kind of send traffic through Canada for 14 billionths of a second or whatever. and seriously, this is an obvious gigantic loophole. And in fact, it's funny because it's not exactly new. You may recall, or maybe you don't know, back in Prohibition days, the Canadians had a law against exporting alcohol to the United States. And there was this little tiny French island off the coast of Canada. And what they would do is ship all the liquor there, and then it would ship from there to the United States. And that was perfectly legal as far as the Canadians were concerned, because it sort of... It was, you know, they were exporting to France.
and I bet you have a couple of bottles of that in your little bar in your living room there, right?
it's a big bar, Andy. No, I don't have any pre-prohibition liquor in there. But this is the sort of, you know, touch base, get out of jail free international loophole that when it comes to wiretapping is sort of problematic. And people aren't talking about the fact that, you know, traffic just goes wherever the heck these days.
Well, here's my sort of take on it. And again, this is just my own opinion. I actually don't have a problem with the authorities that exist because, in fact, we do need better policing of the bad stuff that's going on. And unfortunately, sometimes that means that you've got to, you know, come across some traffic that may be, you know, not of interest,
right,
but may involve U.S. citizens. So,
right.
So where I come down on it is, if we collectively agree that the law doesn't address the situation adequately, then let's adjust the law in a way that still takes into account law enforcement's need to get at certain communications. Because here's the flip side of it, and this is where, you know, law enforcement, it's a no-win situation.
Yeah.
If they do too much monitoring, and if they come across too much traffic that is domestic or incidentally domestic, I'm sorry, incidentally international, and so therefore, you know, mainly it's focused on domestic actors,
yeah,
well, then they're overstepping their bounds. On the other hand, if the bad guys come in and they own several corporations for several billions of dollars worth of IP, then they're not doing their job.
Right. So it's a tricky situation.
Hey, in the course that I teach at GW, one thing I always focus on is balance. Mm-hmm. And what we need here, I think, is a balance that makes people realize that the authorities, I won't call out any specific three-letter agencies that I may have worked at, they're not necessarily listening in on stuff that they're not supposed to be.
Well,
they're,
but
for the
look,
most
so,
part,
so let's talk about the giant vacuum cleaners from the old days, right? So
sure.
The problem is you have to, even if you're doing pen monitoring, which is the idea of where calls originate and end,
mm-hmm.
Even if you're doing that, you have to look at all the traffic to figure out which ones you're supposed to keep, right? So
but unlike the old days,
Carnivore was looking at everything and dropping most stuff, theoretically, right?
Well, I guess the one thing that people, I haven't seen anyway, people talking about too much is, let's define, I forget the verb you use, looking at or, you know, monitoring or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Are these human beings looking at your email to your significant other? No, these are machines that are just scanning for certain code words.
Yeah, it's not the email to the significant other that you're worried about. It's the one to your mistress. That's the one.
Well, yeah. Well, I wasn't going to go there, thank
you. Come on, man. We're talking about the real world here.
Sure. So
there are a lot of people who believe for whatever reason that their email is private, which is rather silly, unless they're crypting it up.
Understood. But I think there needs to be, again, back to the balance issue, there needs to be an understanding that in order to get their job done, law enforcement does need to look at stuff. And let's put some limits on it. I'm not saying they should have unlimited access. But at the same time, I think people need to understand that it does not mean that their every single word is getting scanned.
No, absolutely. So it's kind of like this. I think you can imagine the world is a big, giant, dark stage filled with, you know, billions of people. And there are these unbelievably bright lights. And if the lights shine on you, you're toast.
Yeah, that's true.
And they're sort of sweeping around the stage. And you know, so they're going to illuminate stuff going on stage that they're not interested in. But that's kind of the way it works right now.
Yeah. Well, and this is where I go back to, and I think you were sort of echoing this point in a slightly different way. You've heard the old saying, never write what you can speak, never speak what you can nod, never nod what you can wink.
Right.
I mean,
right.
If you don't want your stuff to have that light illuminating on it, don't put it in an email. But anyway, I digress.
Okay. All right. So let's get philosophical. Does security always trade off against privacy?
Trade-off, I think, is a difficult way of saying it, because that implies that you're losing something. When I'm talking about balance, I'm talking about a well-informed decision,
mm-hmm.
to some extent give up some privacy rights in order to be secure. And I think this is not a static thing. This
not
is
at
a
all.
Dynamic balance that, you know, you have to adjust as the threats change, as the technology changes. And I think, you know, going back to what I was saying a little bit earlier, we're seeing that right now. Technology has advanced so much, so fast, and our laws just haven't kept up.
Absolutely.
So now we're
we're scrambling to try and put something into place that at least to some extent will help with that balance. Now, I think the one thing I applaud with lawmakers today is they really are giving privacy a hard look in these new bills that are coming out. They are making sure to include privacy as a consideration, which is what all of the different, you know, the commission report that we put out, the 90-day Melissa Hathaway report, and all of the subsequent things since then have pointed out you've got to balance security against whatever, I'm sorry, you've got to balance privacy against whatever security you're going to be putting in place.
Right, right. So I think most of those things have resulted in public-private partnership platitudes, just to put a little alliterative point on it. But yeah, there's a different way of asking the question, which I think the answer is yes. So does anonymity trade off against security? And I think the answer there is always yes. What do you think?
When you say trade off, can we... Let me see if I understand the question and ask it a different way. Are you asking whether or not we can have anonymity in the internet age, or do we have to get rid of it altogether?
Well, and be secure enough for whatever it is we want to do. All this.
Okay. I'm gonna jump on that secure enough thing. and here's why. I think the answer is, you know, respectfully disagreeing. No, we don't have to give up anonymity if we don't want to.
Okay.
But I think it comes down to the issue of how secure do you want to be. And what I would point to is the relatively new NSTIC, the National Strategy for Trust Identities in Cyberspace,
yep.
Which is somewhat, it's based on a number of different things, but one of which is the MO404 memo that talked about the four levels of assurance, one of which is, essentially basic assurance. And the NSTIC contemplates the ability for someone to assert their credentials from an anonymous standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but again, it then becomes a question of who's at the receiving end of that and are they going to accept it?
Yep.
So it really is a security question, but it becomes what we're doing now is instead of saying yes or no, you can or cannot have anonymity,
yep.
It's more of a dynamic. You get to choose as the relying party whether or not you want to accept this anonymous person.
Yeah, you know, that it's an interesting way of construing it. Very clever, I think, but it's kind of like the Java 2 security model when we were a bunch of technical people who said, wow, wouldn't it be great if you could have shades of gray policy about the mobile code that you run? guess how many people use that today on planet Earth? Oh, let's
right.
say zero, because, you know, when it comes to complicated policies, the answer is, well, it's just a binary trust model.
That's let's punt.
Bell LaPadula
yep.
is all we can end up with, no matter how hard we try to have something more complicated, because people just can't deal with a policy in their head.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column, InSecurity, published by Search Security. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at sigital.com/GEM/writings, or you can do a quick search on the Search Security website. Thanks for listening. So let's push this down the legal angle a little bit more. So it strikes me as a total, neophyte when it comes to the law and cyber law as well, that much law must deal with attribution, figuring out who did what when.
Yes.
You know, but on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog.
Mm-hmm.
So, when it comes to things like evidence, how do we know that bits aren't just fabricated?
Well, attribution is the number one issue when we start to talk about either active defense or offensive activity, or simply, like you said, figuring out who did what to whom. And it is the number one problem because you can very easily hide who you are or where you're coming from. I go all the way back to I'm blanking out on the name of the book. It'll come to me in a minute. But when you look at some of these attacks, we're involved in an active breach right now. And when you look at the different IP hops that have occurred and try to figure out where the person was coming from, it's virtually impossible. These attackers are... You know, everyone says, oh, they're so sophisticated. I wouldn't necessarily agree that they're sophisticated. They're using tools, first of all, that are designed to help them hide.
Yeah.
But they're also very persistent.
Yep.
So if there's a way for them to do something, they will figure it out. And if that way doesn't work, they'll figure out another way.
Mm-hmm.
It was the cuckoo's egg, Cliff Stoll, back in late 80s. If you look inside the front of the book, this was one of my first realizations of how bad the problem was, and this is in the late 80s, he shows the map of that attack.
Yeah.
And that was back in the late 80s, and it was an incredibly sophisticated attack through a number of different hops.
And he noticed by, you know, some accounting error that was in the pennies.
Exactly. Exactly.
Cliff is a weird dude.
Very persistent man. Yes, indeed. Well, I think here's an indication of how bad the attribution problem is. So
right.
We've stood up Cyber Command, and General Alexander, you know, Director of NSA, is also in charge of Cyber Command. And at a House Armed Services Committee hearing, he pointed out, he was asked the question by the panel of what is the U.S. policy on essentially launching an offensive type of attack in the cyber realm.
Even in retribution.
Yes, exactly. Not exactly.
Yeah.
In response to something, not
right.
unprovoked.
Just making that clear.
Thank you. And he responded with the attribution issue, and that was his main response.
Yeah.
The only thing he talked about was
his
legal advisors said, you cannot take action unless you are absolutely sure, and how can you ever be absolutely sure?
Well, and it gets worse, too. I mean, when we have international norms conversations with the Russians, we just speak, not only do we literally speak a different language, but we have a different idea about what cybercrime is.
Yeah.
And you know, for us, basic human rights are being trampled in Russia because the opposition is having their computers seized because of so-called computer crime, while we have the Russian business network rampaging around like a bunch of pirates. it's just amazing. And so this gets even worse when you get to the cyber war issue, which you just invoked.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Washington's pretty wound around the axle on that one. So I have a question about that. Is cybercrime more important than cyber war, in your view?
Let me give a lawyer's answer. It depends.
Weasel.
Well, I think first you hit on something a minute ago that needs to be expanded on in the context of the question just asked, and that's the definitional problem. So cyber war, cyber crime, cyber espionage, cyber intrusion. I mean, there's a whole bunch of descriptors out there, and nobody has quite agreed to what each of these things is, and more importantly, from a policy perspective, what constitutes one versus the other.
If I hear the DDoS attack story one more time in Congress, I'm just going to smack some heads. I mean, it's like, you know what, guys? Google and Amazon, they wouldn't even notice. Actually, they would have noticed. They would have gone, oh, look at that little ant tickling my little toe. Let me mush
right.
it.
This is our 1,000th one today.
Yeah.
But I think it's a...
And they're like, it took down a whole country. It's like, yeah, but it's Estonia.
Right, exactly.
They were connected with a 9600 baud modem.
That they were sharing.
With Latvia.
So you say cyber war, you know, D.C. is wound around the axle about cyber war.
Yeah.
We don't even have agreement down here of what that is. So it's, you know, it's hard to say, yes, it's really an issue, a bigger issue than cyber crime. I think the better way to look at it is from a societal perspective,
mm-hmm.
which is more important.
That's kind of what I meant. So what's the answer?
Well, I would actually say cybercrime,
yeah,
just based on my experience with my clients. Is cyber war a sexy, something you see in the movies kind of thing that's, you know, fun to talk about and people write books about it, et cetera? Yeah. Could enough instructions be executed across enough computers to bring down an electric grid?
Oh,
sure. That could happen.
Yeah. It's easy, actually. You know, and Stuxnet let the cat out of the bag in terms of program logic controllers and
yep.
the way we built that stuff. And, you know, those of us who wear tinfoil hats for a living, we've known this forever.
Exactly. But I think the bigger issue, so that, yes, that could occur. I'm not saying it couldn't, and I'm not saying we shouldn't pay attention to it. But yeah. I think the bigger issue is the literally billions of dollars. And that's, I'm talking about one company of which I'm aware that has lost billions of dollars in intellectual property.
Yeah.
Because,
well Aurora, Google, we've got, you know, Lockheed Martin and the RSA stuff.
Yep.
General Dynamics and Northrop Grumman, and there are more. But those,
and
are,
for
the,
every,
those are the ones
for,
that everybody knows about.
For every one of those you've mentioned, I don't know what the right number is, probably somewhere between 5 and I don't even want to estimate, there are that many other companies that you don't hear about.
Right, of course.
Whose IP is getting stolen, whose, you know, and essentially our economy is suffering as a result.
So here's what I think the answer is. All these things are important, and what we have to focus on is how do we solve both problems. And the cool thing is we can kill both birds with one stone if we focus on building stuff right. In my
Agreed.
Obviously, you know, software security is my big thing, and I just believe the heck out of it. I wish that we could get the policymakers to understand that until we start building stuff better, we're just going to be stuck with these thorny conundrums.
Well, I've, as you know, I've got enough gray hair to remember the Fram oil filter campaign from many, many years ago. You're laughing, so you know which one I'm talking about. Pay me now or pay me later.
All right.
So you can put the money in up front. Yeah. You can buy the $1,000 machine, or you can buy the $1,500 machine, and maybe you need to buy 100 of them. So we're talking some serious money.
Yeah.
But down the road, if you bought the $1,000 machine, you may be paying $3,000 for each of those machines to clean it up after someone's gotten in and attacked it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in full agreement, but I think that mentality still has not clicked with, you know, Main Street in a way, because the companies that, you know, build stuff for Main Street, because most people are focused on the bottom line. And
well,
if I
yeah,
can save that.
It's the same, though, with Washington. I mean, the over-focus is on sexy weaponry, right?
Yes.
We want the cyber equivalent of a Predator drone. And we forgot that we're living in a glass house while we're working on faster, better, more accurate rock throwing.
I would say that was the attitude until fairly recently.
Uh-huh.
I think we're taking baby steps there. If you look at again, the two front runners, Cybersecurity Act of 2012 and the Secure IT or Secure It Act of 2012.
Things are going the right way.
Well, like I said, baby steps. They're talking about
if it's Lieberman, you know, it has to be baby steps.
Well, we don't have time
to
go into this.
Do we have opinions? Yes, we do.
But I think the nice thing that you see in both of these is that they are coming up with ways that will allow information sharing in a way that, you know, at least one approach involves limiting liability. So if you do share information, mm-hmm. you know that you won't have a lawsuit brought against you because you said, "Hey, I had a problem and I had a breach."
All right.
Which
you're gonna make me take a big left turn. This is super important. So
okay.
Some misguided security experts, and I use misguided on purpose, think that software liability might help improve our broken, vulnerable systems. But I guess they've never met the Microsoft legal team. So what do you think about software liability in general as a lever?
I think balance is the important thing. Could something be put in place that would essentially incent people to do the right thing without penalizing people too much? Yes, we could get there, but I think it's going to be a difficult road in light of the path that we've gone down. So as you know, software is licensed, it's not owned.
Right.
So the entire realm of product liability law goes out the door. We don't even deal with that when
yeah,
we're talking about software.
Yeah, it's contract law, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so as a result, you, as everyone knows, companies can disclaim all liability.
The good thing about contracts is if you're stupid enough to agree to a really egregious contract, the court won't uphold it. They'll say, oh, you're too stupid. You shouldn't have agreed to that.
Unfortunately, yes, that's correct in the consumer context. But those are, I won't say few and far between, but those certainly aren't common.
Right.
But the bigger problem is at an enterprise level, when you're talking about B2B, where a lot of these problems are really showing up. I mean, mm-hmm. my client that's had a data breach, is it because some consumer did something dumb and they can point to software? No, it's because they used software that had a flaw in it, mm-hmm. but they said in their contract, we take on, you know, we're going to accept a disclaimer of liability.
I understand, yeah.
And no court is going to, when it's a knowledgeable business talking to a knowledgeable business or contracting with, you know, two knowledgeable companies contracting with each other, no court is going to throw out an agreement because of, you know, a claim, oh, you know, that's unenforceable.
You were too stupid, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, so, interesting. I guess when it comes to the government, you could do that. Cause...
I won't touch that.
All right. Here's another one real quick. So
sure.
It's the recent 11th Circuit decision. So can the government demand my crypto key?
Oh, throwing the bombshell at the end. Maybe, depending on which circuit you're in. No, we're in an interesting situation where there's a split amongst the circuits, and there are differing decisions. And I think the position that makes the most logic, or the most logical position, is the one that says the following: if I know enough about you, I know you, Gary, had that laptop that has been seized legally under a warrant, a properly served warrant, mm-hmm. and that's in evidence. And I know because I've been through various legal means, you know, watching your conversations or whatever, mm-hmm. You know, a legal wiretap. I know that you were talking to one of your buddies and you said that you've got the password to that machine.
Right.
And I, in fact, know by evidence that on that machine are certain files that will incriminate you. Mm-hmm. I have all of these things. I know these things. Mm-hmm. And I hear I'm the government. I just put myself in that position. I didn't
understand.
Want to do that. But
I
anyway,
understand.
If I've got all of that, and then I say to you, I'm not going to say to you, give me your password. I'm going to say to you, walk over to that machine, put your password in,
right.
so I never know it.
Right.
And I will then image that hard drive and get that evidence. That's a very different situation than law enforcement coming in, seizing a machine,
yeah.
not knowing what's on it,
yeah.
not knowing whether or not the person even owns it. That's the fact I left out in the first scenario. You also own that machine. I established that.
Yeah.
But in the other scenario, I don't know that the person, or the government doesn't know that the person owns the machine.
Yeah.
They don't know that they have access.
Well,
they don't know what's on there.
The 11th Circuit decision was about child porn, and the thing was in a hotel room, and it was seized, and it was John Doe case, and it wasn't clear who owned the stuff.
Right.
So,
exactly.
So I understand that. So it's really worth looking into if you're not, for those listeners who aren't legal people like me. Interesting stuff going on
at
the edge of the law right now. Gosh, I got so many other things I want to ask you, but we've already like completely popped our time budget. One last question. Your firm has been likened to the equivalent of a legal Silicon Valley startup, featuring flexible hours and jeans and wine tastings in the Washington Post. Is it easy to compete with the old school cigar-chomping hourly grinders or what?
I would say yes, for a couple different reasons. First of all, the legal field is changing, and the billable hour is no longer the sort of the king of the hill. And there are a lot of, you know, one word, big law, as it's known. There are a number of firms, big law firms, that still go mostly by the billable hour.
Mm-hmm.
You have a lot of small boutique firms, both ours, you know, a cybersecurity focused or a cyber focused firm, and other firms that offer you know, fixed fee arrangements, monthly retainers, all kinds of flexible arrangements that clients are looking for. Mm-hmm. And then I think the other thing is, because we are focused in a specific area, people know that when they come to us, we have that expertise. We have a team of people that run the gamut across, you know, cybersecurity and can address all these different issues.
Yeah, and young and energetic and so on.
Exactly.
All the right memes apply. All right. very last question. What's your current favorite fiction book?
Fiction book? Oh.
Yeah, you can't say Cyber War, because though that is fiction, it's published as a nonfiction.
No, the one I'm reading right now is one of the Kurzweil books about singularity. So I hesitated because I don't know if you consider that fiction, but I'm very intrigued by this whole notion of the singularity. I think it's the singularity is near is the mm-hmm. one that I'm reading now, mm-hmm. and it just fascinates me with the speed with which technology is changing. And I'm always reading it, of course, thinking, well, the bad guys are using the same technology at mm-hmm. that same speed.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm. that's a good enough answer. We'll let you off the hook with that one. Thanks a lot. This has been absolutely a fantastic conversation, and I appreciate your candor in these difficult
issues. I've enjoyed it.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The January-February issue of IEEE S&P is the 10th anniversary issue. Happy birthday, S&P. In addition to lots of articles on authentication, the issue features a discussion / debate about the last decade of computer security between myself and Anoop Ghosh, and I win, of course. So subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigil.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.